Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us on this very fine World Cup day on Queensbury Rules Radio. I'm Patrick Connor of Queensbury Rules, and also here with me today is Tim Starks of Queensbury Rules. Tim.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I didn't know if I was live.
No,
I'm great.
You're live.
We do. You're right. We totally did plan this really well with the World Cup happening like right now. See, I'm bad at math. I thought that, like, okay, 90 minutes is how much the game lasts, but then they also have that halftime, and then they also have a stoppage time or whatever that weird rule is.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to really pretend that I watch a whole lot of soccer, so I don't know what to say. Sorry, people, but whatever, you're going to have to deal with it. Tune in after we lose. Anyway.
That's very unpatriotic. I do not endorse that statement.
I know. Well, as far as this whole boxing thing goes, is it fair to say that this has been the best June for a year that ends in 0-1-4?
I would go one farther. I would say it is the best year, the best month for the best June for boxing in a year that ends 2014.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's safe to say. We actually have been a little bit treated, I think.
Yeah, it's been kind of weird. Like, there's this kind of weird debate about how much these are actually good matchups versus how much they are just getting lucky that their showcase fights turned out to be good. I should say that, like, obviously Crawford Gamboa wasn't a showcase fight, but, you know, if you think of the best fights we've had this year, they've been several of them are ones that nobody expected to be all that competitive. And then, you know, it puts you in this weird state of mind as a boxing fan where you're like, well, shit, man, maybe that Danny Garcia fight is going to kick ass. And of course that's what Espinoza from Showtime wants us to think. But, you know, it's hard. At a certain point, you're like, how much disbelief should I suspend? Is this actually going to keep happening where the fight that looks shitty on paper is actually pretty good, but then you have a string of them where they're all shitty, as expected, and then you're like, yeah, no, I probably was all right to go ahead and think they were shitty.
Well, Steven Espinoza may or may not be part of the Illuminati. So, I mean, just to kind of get that out of the way. But no, I'm kidding. I don't really believe that shit. Anyway,
I know you don't. But he does. Does he drink the Monster Energy drink or whatever? Does he drink that? Because I saw something about the 666 and the Illuminati and the sign of the beast on that one.
I know he's down with the ultimate. I know he's down with the ultimate sack. That might be enough to indict him.
Anybody who's a member of the Ultimate Sack crew, clearly Illuminati or Satanist or both. I think they're the same, aren't they? If you're Illuminati,
no,
you're also a Satanist.
Tomato, tomato. I mean, you actually did mention that point, though, in I think it was your quick jabs. I think it was either yesterday or the day before, but you did mention that, and I think that it is kind of funky to note anyway that We have kind of gotten a few good fights. You know, I mean, the first, I don't know, 4 to 5 months of the year were, I don't want to say uneventful. Well, that actually is kind of what they were. They were kind of uneventful.
Definitely.
Well, the only thing that we really had scheduled were a couple of bigger matchups that might deliver maybe, you know. And so the last month or two has really been where we've gotten the action.
Thank God for John Molina. Thank God for Yoshihiro kind of guy. Thank God for Salka, I guess, soon. Yeah, it's all going to be great. Everything's going to work out wonderfully.
Yeah. Well, it's just I have to ask the same questions that you ask. How much of it is just blind luck? You know, that they've how much of it has had the intention behind it to actually put on good matchups, you know? Yeah, I don't really know. I don't even know if we'll ever know the answer to those questions. But in any event, this last weekend, we actually did get more than we had expected in a number of different ways. And even though a lot of us had expected quite a lot from Terrence Crawford versus Yuriorkis Gamboa, why don't you run us through that fight or your thoughts on that fight?
Yeah, you know, I didn't expect a fight that was particularly competitive. I really, as much as I used to be the biggest, the biggest driver, the biggest rider of the Gamboa bandwagon, to the point that people still, like, even though 2 years ago we stopped capitalizing his name and putting a bunch of exclamation points at the end, people still are surprised when I say anything negative about Gamboa. Like, 2 years ago, I literally put it in the smallest typeface I could put it in because I had been so turned off by the guy. But I still,
the Rios,
you know,
thing is what kind of did it.
The Rios was the final straw, yeah, for me.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd had a few things that he had been doing right before that were kind of annoying. But, yeah, you know, I just think he's too small. And it turns out I'm right. He is too small to be a lightweight, damn if he still doesn't have some of that explosiveness that really made him special looking at 126. So I didn't expect it to be competitive because of the size, but it turned out it was competitive in some ways despite the size, and that was the thing that we got that I didn't expect. I thought there was a chance it might not be quote unquote boring, even though. There are people, it's amazing how quickly things turn. I mean, it wasn't really that long ago that people, I wrote a column about, you know, boring isn't all boring. There are certain kinds of boring fighters that are boring in different ways, and what you think is boring is not necessarily boring. Crawford was one of them that I thought was not boring, but that other people were saying, oh, he's boring, you know, he's a counterpuncher, he's too conservative on offense, he doesn't mix it up. And some of those things were true, but I also just really liked his power and, you know, I liked his will to fight when someone forced him to. So I just didn't think it would be competitive, and it was, so it's like, oh, great, we've got a competitive matchup, and I did not expect that. That was part one, and then part two, there were some really, really nice exchanges. Like, there was I think it was at the end of the eighth round, where they just stood there and smashed each other. I did not expect that to happen that as often as it did, and of course the momentum swings were pretty sweet with the way has anybody ever seen Crawford hurt before? I had not. And so he got hurt in that ninth round and came back. So I really enjoyed the fight. Did you expect it to be more competitive than I did? I don't know. I don't remember.
No, I was pretty much on board with the prevailing thought, which was pretty much what you had, was, you know, it was that Gamboa had a chance because of his explosive type of offense, but at the same time, Crawford should be favored, albeit maybe not by that much. You know, a competitive fight going in with a favorite in Crawford, probably. But, you know, the dead horse has probably been beaten on a little bit as far as the cliche about a losing, you know, a guy who loses his stock going up. But I'd have to say that this is one of those fights that kind of qualifies. And for a few different reasons, Gamboa showed up in a way that a lot of people didn't think he could or would, especially given the physical, you know, like the height disparity, the reach disparity, and he also just looked like a smaller guy, maybe a guy who wasn't as strong. He kind of just, he had to throw just right in order to land, and he still managed to land, especially over those first few rounds, which was surprising. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was one of the contributing factors to it actually being considered a pretty good fight, too. But it was a good fight. There were some really good exchanges in there that were high-level, you know, exchanges, not just kind of blind mugging, and that's the type of stuff that I like to see, you know, the mix of skill and the, you know, the blood too, and the guys getting hurt and knocked down and all that type of stuff, you know, all of those things coming together makes for a pretty damn good fight.
Well said, sir. I'm in the crew of people who can enjoy a good strategic fight because I like watching the adjustments being made, and that was one of the things that made this cool is that we got both. You know, it was really I liked if the fight had not had that much action, but we saw it go from Gamboa in control to Crawford taking back control with his adjustments that he made, which were really, really smart, good adjustments. I still would have really liked the fight. But the fact that we got both the fight that the brawling oriented fans want and that the people who like the high level boxing action want is really what made it a pretty enjoyable fight.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, the just about any time a fight is good, and I mean past what, you know, the normal kind of, you know, that was a good fight type of goes. But any time there's something even remotely special about a fight, of course, the fight of the year discussion gets turned on. You know, they did last week for Robert Guerrero versus Kamagai, et cetera, et cetera. So in your opinion, as far as this whole fight of the year talk goes, do you think that this should be in the running, Crawford-Gamboa?
In the running, yes. I can't go any farther than that yet, or further. The reason is because I just think that Matisse versus Molina was so much better. It didn't have quite the same level of high level, of course, but it did have a decent amount. I mean, it was a pretty well-thought bout in terms of the strategy elements of it and how Matisse made some of his adjustments to deal with the height. And the way, you know, Molina surprised us with his performance. I mean, some of the elements were very similar, right? We had a fighter who people thought was a solid underdog really put up a stiff challenge, but the challenge was stiffer, if you get my drift, in the Molina fight. And there was more back-and-forth action, and I don't know if there were more. There might not have been more knockdowns, but there were more. The knockdowns were more distributed. The hurtings were more distributed. So that to me makes it better. I guess then it's kind of everybody else for me right now. There was a fight that I meant to catch up with. I saw people talking about on Twitter, as in, you know, hey, why is everybody leaving X fight out of the fight of the year list? And it was because the two fighters were less well known. I don't know if you remember the ones. Do you know the one I'm talking about? It was Coyne and someone. Is this way too obscure? It was kind of an obscure fight.
I'm not sure. Off the top of my head, I don't know.
All right, I meant to track it down and got distracted for some reason or another.
Well,
and
it happens,
didn't get a chance. To
it happens down. To me all the. It happens to me all the time anyway, because of, you know, work schedules, I'm often not able to watch, you know, cards that are going on in Brunei at 2 a.m. my time on the internet. So I wind up having to track down these types of things. But, yeah, it happens all the time, and there are always fights that just kind of go under the radar, you know, that otherwise not know about at all. But off the top of my head, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I try to do my part if I see a fight that's just nutso to send people that way. There was a round between a couple Asian guys just blasting each other that it was not – there was nothing at all like boxing skill being displayed. But I passed it along anyway just because it was, you know, ridiculous. And I'm failing the listeners of your esteemed show, which is – I feel terrible because I am no Foley – I am just Tim.
Well, I don't know though, because you do tend to watch Friday night fights, so I don't know. You might have the edge over him because of that. It's up in the air though.
That's part of his charm. That's part of his charm.
That's true.
The fact that he refuses to watch it, that makes him better than me. I have no charm. That's another area where I fall short. For whatever mild increase in knowledge I get, the charm trade-off is not enough.
You do wear that hat a lot, though.
The charm
at
hat?
At least in pictures. Well, the pictures that I see of you, you wear, like, you know, a fedora-looking thing. So, hey.
I wear the Pharrell hat all the time. I wear the Arby's hat
there
just nonstop.
Yep. Makes you happy. Yeah, I'll go low. I don't care. So, you know, it came out, I think it was yesterday, the numbers for – it might even have been this morning. I don't know. Time all blends together for me. But the numbers for Crawford-Gamboa actually came back fairly high, or at least, you know, higher than I think a lot of people expected, especially for, you know, there are a handful of different things going against it. You know, it's a fight against between lightweights, number one, you know, and that's kind of like the cutoff. Lightweight, welterweight, that's kind of the cutoff as far as the weight goes, where the interest really seems to just drop off, you know. And then on top of that, it happened in Omaha. I don't know. I mean, no offense to Omaha. Just going in, a lot of people were kind of just like, Omaha. I mean, we get that Crawford's from Omaha, but really? Like, why Omaha? So there were a handful of different factors just kind of going against it, yet the ratings came back good, and it sold really well live. So, you know, how much is this going to help Crawford going forward? You know, should they continue to market Crawford to Omaha, et cetera? What does this mean?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many reasons the numbers are interesting. I mean, Gamboa is a guy who's been on HBO a lot. But so, you know, that helps, having some name recognition. But if you look back over Gamboa's numbers and all of these fights, they're fucking terrible. Like, he has, you know, at the bottom of some of the worst showings for HBO over the last few years. He just doesn't move fans. Like, a lot of Cuban fighters have that problem, so it's not like it's unique to him. That was interesting. The fact that, you know, again, Crawford had been tagged with this boring label here and there, you know, in some of the fights that have been on HBO, people have been like, snore, wake me when this fight is over. His last fight wasn't even on HBO, which was, again, you know, it was totally mystifying that the best opponent he was facing wasn't on HBO. So I don't know what it was that moved the fans. I mean, sometimes you can fall in a sweet spot where it's just like, oh, there was nothing else on that night, like. there was no NBA happening. There was no NBA finals. There's nothing like, there was really, maybe there was nothing all that competing with it is part of why. Or maybe, you know what, maybe the buzz about there being a guy who could be, you know, an American star in this step-up fight against an opponent that people had heard of, maybe it really brought out the hardcores. But it's really, it's the number two fight of the year so far in terms of ratings, average ratings on cable. And it beat out, like, Juan Manuel Marquez, who usually does really good numbers. So there are so many ways in which the number is impressive and weird and don't understand why it was like this, and you can only really speculate. I mean, on the Omaha thing, you can kind of put your finger on it, right? Which is, here's a town that hasn't gotten much live boxing. They've got a guy who is a local guy. You know, I don't know if I want to call them the Midwest. I guess they're sort of the Midwest. I'm from the Midwest, and we like, you know, we've got all this sort of a regional patriotism going for us. And they turned out for him in a way that makes total sense. I don't know that they'll do it on that level again. If you look at guys like Devin Alexander or Andre Ward or people who put up really good numbers in their first big step-up fights at home, and the way they were then inconsistent thereafter, where it was much more matchup based or name based, or it's the novelty can wear off sometimes. But there's no doubt that he can now make an argument that he is, after Floyd Mayweather, the biggest American U.S. attraction. You know, obviously, guys like Pacquiao can do bigger gates, and guys like Chavez and Canelo can do bigger gates, but they are not American-born, so that makes a difference, and that gives him leverage. On the other hand, I don't know that that's a totally good thing, because the people who are at lightweight that he could fight, there's not a whole lot more names that are like, wow, that guy is just as popular or well-known as Uriah Gamboa, and then at 140, there's some problems. So I don't know if we want him to have, like, crazy leverage where he then is like, well, look at how 11,000 people came and saw me, 1.2 million, baby. I would like $3 million for my next fight against anybody, anybody who's not good. It might not be a good thing that this is happening.
That actually kind of gives me a good little opening there, pause, to talk about the Transnational Boxing Rankings Board. Sorry, I had to pause right before I got into, like,
it's,
you know,
all right.
More
look,
important.
I leave all.
Okay. Hopefully,
there's,
I didn't.
There's so many openings. There's so many openings that I want you to fill.
Okay. Yes. All right. That didn't sound creepy enough. So. Anyway, my whole reason for me bringing that up is, of course, because, number one, you are the chair of the Transnational Boxing Ranking Board, which just recently got a very nice endorsement from Teddy Atlas and Joe Tessitore on Friday Night Fights the other day. But also the reason why I bring that up is because Terrence Crawford is, according to the TBRB, ranked number one at lightweight. And as of now, he's defeated two other fighters in the top 10 in Burns and Gamboa, now Gamboa. So with Miguel Vasquez, you know, I mean, if you consider this important or relevant, he's the longest reigning belt holder at lightweight anyway. But with him signing with Al Haymon over a supersized McRib value meal at McDonald's, it pretty much all but destroys the chances that there could be a new lineage created at lightweight with them fighting one another. So on one hand, it probably won't be a very high-action fight if they did fight, but on the other hand, it would be an important fight for the division and potentially for boxing. I mean, so as far as both that goes in the context of Crawford fighting Vasquez and in the context of the Transnational Boxing Rankings Board, how do we know which one to choose? How do we know whether to choose that it's an important fight over an entertaining fight or vice versa? I know that that's kind of like a vague question and difficult to answer, but I figured, you know, at least in the context, it might be, it might lead to more explanation as far as the Transnational Boxing Rankings Board is concerned.
Sure. And I appreciate the hard questioning. There's a value in that. So just to back up on a thought, when you mentioned Gamboa, and we were talking about Gamboa and whether he was a lightweight, we left him at number seven. I didn't think he even belonged in the top 10 at 135. I thought that was a bad ranking that the board made, which goes to show that no one person, no handful of people control what happens on the board. It's a by consensus kind of thing.
Yeah.
That he was even in the rankings, I didn't think he belonged. I just thought he didn't have any resume there. He wasn't stellar in the one fight he had at 135. I thought it was a bad call. But now that he's, you know, fought the guy who has an argument for being the best guy in the division, well, shit, actually, number seven sounds about right. And maybe, you know, there was some argument even for moving him up because of that. So, you know, based on the fact that Gamboa looked like, if not an inflated lightweight, a guy who definitely can compete at lightweight and could be considered an authentic contender at lightweight, that makes the Crawford win better than if you're just using number versus number. But as far as, you know, it's a little disappointing. I would say it's more than a little disappointing that we won't get Crawford Vasquez. And I hate watching Vasquez fight as much as everyone else, if not more. I do not enjoy it. There's something interesting about it, I guess, and the first time you see it, I have, you know, my roommate, we were watching it, and he was kind of impressed by him, and in retrospect, yeah, what he does is kind of interesting to watch, but only for a few rounds, and certainly not for years and years and years. So in the sense that he's not fun to watch, the Crawford fight becomes not fun to watch. Any fight that Vasquez is in is not fun to watch. That's just math. But the reason I'm disappointed is because it suddenly becomes an interesting fight, not, of course, for the action it would produce or not produce, but because of the importance. And that's all individual taste, man. I don't blame anyone for wanting any fight for any reason that they want them. I like to see champions crowned, and I like to see the new lineages created. I think that necessarily makes the championship fight better than all the other fights. It adds an element to it that makes it appealing, and that's what you can say for it. You know, if it's a fight that is terrible on paper but it's also important, that makes it better than if it wasn't important. And that's all I've ever said with that. And then, of course, if a fight has got all kinds of action and has sexiness written all over it before they even get in the ring, and it's important, that makes it better. It always makes it better. It doesn't mean that the important fight is always more desirable. So I'm disappointed that Miguel Vasquez, you know, for what amounted to a happy meal, clearly from the picture, he was lured by the SpongeBob SquarePants toy or something. I don't know why he needed Haymon. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's not like Top Rank wasn't getting in fights, and now we won't get that fight. I'm not terribly, terribly disappointed, but it is a little disappointing.
Well, and now on top of that, well, first of all, it was probably the warm apple pie that did it. But past that,
true.
Past that, I mean, it's, I don't really understand it in the sense that, you know, it's not like Miguel Vasquez has some type of untapped potential or some type of, like, you know, entertainment value that just hasn't really been exposed yet. We've pretty much seen from him what we're going to see. And it's not that he isn't a good fighter. He's a fine fighter and a very, you know, sharp boxer. But on the other hand, I, you know, yeah, you pretty much said it. I'm not really very interested in watching him fight. But, you know, on top of that, I think that, I think, well, I was just going to say, I think you answered the question well, because there's a lot of subtleties. There's, it's not just black and white. You know, it's not just, well, it's entertainment value over importance. You know, there's kind of like room for all of these different things to get along a lot of the time. So in any event, mm-hmm. I thought you answered that, you know, satisfactorily. No, you answered it well.
Thank you very much. Here's the other thing. I never quite understood. I was talking about this with a friend online. If they're listening, they'll know who they are. I was talking with a friend online about what the hell was Miguel Vasquez even doing in Aram's stable? He was only ever going to piss him off. He's exactly the kind of fighter that Aram doesn't like to promote. But he had him in the stable and was getting him good fights. It's like he doesn't like, he signed Rigondo and he didn't want to promote him. He signed Miguel Vasquez and was promoting him anyway. He was only ever going to spoil shit for other fighters that Aram liked. It wasn't like he was rolling in the dough or bringing in the fan. I mean, I think there's a place for fighters like Vasquez. I don't mean him exactly. There's a place for fighters who are not as fun to watch. But why Aram, who's always harping on action, wanted Vasquez from the start but was still doing a decent job with him is confusing to me.
Yeah, Mercito Hesta is a pretty damn good example of that. And, I mean, it's not like they were pushing him that hard. I think that they probably saw some limitations there before the Vasquez fight, but that alone was kind of just like he stunk it up so badly that was kind of like, all right, kid, we're just going to pretty much rebuild you from the ground up now. So in that sense, mm-hmm. yeah, you pretty much pegged it. He's not really the type of fighter that you would want to have in your stable fighting consistently anyways. But in any event, as far as the possibilities of Terrence Crawford and him go, yeah, it just sucks because at the very least it could just bring clarity. You know, and a lot of the times clarity in these situations where there's just not a clear standout. You know, in the sense that, like I was saying before, Miguel Vasquez is probably he is the longest reigning belt holder in lightweight, but this Gamboa win and the nature of the Gamboa win from Terrence Crawford might have been better than anything Vasquez has done in quite a while. So in that sense, you know, pitting these two against each other, create a new lineage or a new champion, whatever you want to call it, is just kind of a natural. But as far as Gamboa mm-hmm. goes now, what do you think is going to happen from Gamboa? Can he move down, you know, below 135 pounds? Should he, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, he totally should. Maybe he's having trouble making 126, which I don't know why. He's 4'2", and his arms are his arms are toothpick length. So I don't know why he would be having so much trouble. He's a little muscly, maybe. He should be at 126. Failing that, he should be at 130. Failing that, he should, I guess, be at 135. But at that point, you're talking about a lot of failure. I guess there was a certain level of which it made sense to have him at a higher weight, just because, you know, featherweights don't do big ratings and they're not big draws. So I understand that money might have been why he was that high. But he also could have, you know, he could have fought Mikey before the Mikey Garcia situation got weird. He could have fought Mikey Garcia at 130. It didn't need to be at 135. I have to imagine that if you hang around in a division for a while, and this is even imagination, this is just history. If you hang around in a division long enough, someone will come along to make themselves valuable and make them. Oh, sorry, America just got scored on. I had to pause. Let's mourn. Yeah, see you later, America. Sorry to break the news to you TQBR radio listeners.
Oh, America.
America, why did you let these Belgians get us?
No!
America! sad.
Bro, our live listener count just shot up 400% because now nobody's watching that fucking shit. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, we are less disappointing than America.
Yep.
So where were we at? We were talking about Gamboa and where he goes next. I don't know. I would like to see the Garcia fight revived. That fight is still interesting to me. I don't know what the legal status is of Garcia. It seems like he's just floating around out there. The problem for Gamboa, I think, is he's promoted by 50 Cent, who is not good at promoting and doesn't seem, he, like, this was his best fighter, and he didn't like hang around to talk to him after he got knocked out, and it doesn't seem very smart.
Yeah, it was pretty lame.
But, you know, on the other hand, it was real lame. Roger Mayweather did that. No, it wasn't Roger. It was Floyd Mayweather Sr. did that to Ricky Hatton, too. It's really uncool to, like, a guy just lost and you don't, like, at least show him some kind of token, you know, concern or hang around for a little bit. It's not like you're going to suddenly stink of loser just by doing that. The only thing you're going to do is look like a dick for not standing by your fighter. So I think that's a problem for him. Another thing is that, you know, I think there were people who were scared of him for a while. He was, his risk to reward ratio was not good. He was, you know, frighteningly fast and powerful and had no fans. That's a bad combination for a guy to get fights. Now you can see he's beatable. He's clearly a guy who can still fight. And he's got a name, and he enhanced himself with the showing. So he should be in a position to get some more good fights. I don't know how that will actually translate into action.
And I don't even know what the 50 Cent dynamic does at this point, because it's so convoluted to me as far as who can work with who, because, you know, this guy's with Heyman but not Golden Boy, this other guy, I don't really even understand, but... Yeah, I'd have to think that having 50 Cent as a promoter probably isn't going to do many favors anyway, even if by nature, just, you know, 50 Cent just doesn't have a stable. So it's not like he could, you know, keep him busy in the meantime. Every type of negotiation is going to be some type of titanic struggle to get his fighter in, you know, anyway. So yeah, at this point going forward, I'd like to see more of him. More of him than when the fight started anyway. And so, in that sense, mm-hmm. I think that his stock did go up. As far as Crawford goes now, since the Vasquez fight seems to probably be off of the table at this point, where would you like to see him go?
And just one more thought on Gamboa, because you mentioned the wanting to see him more. I think he handled his defeat really well. He was really classy about it. On Twitter, you could feel that he was a little heartbroken about the loss. He had been saying some, you know, douchey things on the internet for a long time, and people are upset at him over the biogenesis and this and that. The guy had racked up a lot of ill will, and I think he got some of it back, not just with the performance, but with the way he behaved after, to his credit. So your question was, where do we want Crawford to go next?
Yeah.
I was thinking about that before we got on the air, and I just blanked on it, so I'm going to go use the computer and look up names. I think that there's basically any fight at lightweight, you know, going down the list. Raimundo Beltran, I like that fight. Maybe not Sharif, but... You know, a Petrov, a Figueroa, some of these guys would be really good fights. Sort of a problem in whether they're bigger enough names or not. I don't know if he needs to go straight to another big name. I think we could live with him going with a smaller name for a little while, maybe two fights at most. Certainly nobody, like, well below a contender level, though. I'd like to see him in there with somebody who has a pulse at minimum. Then, you know, if you... think about the Cold War stuff, that causes a problem. And I know that it might be thawing or what have you, but a lot of the guys who are on the Golden Boy roster who might make interesting fights for him at 135, like a Figueroa, that's a problem, because it's they're guys who are still with Heyman. They're not just with Golden Boy. They're with Heyman, too,
yeah.
or even just with Heyman. So that causes a problem. I do like the idea of him sticking around at 135 for a little while longer and just showing, like, no, seriously, I'm the Baus. I'm straight up the Baus of the 135-pound division before he tries to go on to the bigger weight classes. But there's some, you know, there's some interesting fights there, too, that are along those lines, you know, like a Chris Algieri, assuming he doesn't fight Pacquiao next, because obviously he's going to fight Pacquiao next. A Provodnikov, you know, Brandon, maybe not Brandon Rios. There's so many, there are lots of good names around there that he matches up with pretty well. And it's just, you know, it's, like we talked about already, it's a little disappointing that we don't get the Miguel Vasquez fight, but there's some, still some plenty of good fights. I think if I had to pick one right now, I would say Beltran, you know, that would be makeable.
And something that seems like it would be appropriate, too. I tend to agree with that. I'm kind of hoping that they offer Sharif Bohiri a shot and he turns it down so I can pen an article that entitled Sharif Don't Like It. Because that would just be, you know.
Ah! Oh!
Yeah.
Grayson Fung.
I don't really know where he's going to go because the talk is that he's not going to stay at 135 for very long. And there is something to be said for, you know, climbing up weight classes and winning titles and blah, blah, blah and stuff like that. You know, there is, of course, something to be said for that as far as, you know, it being impressive and all that type of thing. But at the same time, I would hate for him to leave potential, you know, unfinished business behind. If he is going to move up to 140, I hope it's for worthwhile fights and not bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know this was something that I think Lyle Fitzsimmons, my old friend, was banding around in his column. It's not crazy to talk about Pacquiao soonish, in part because Roach has been saying, you know, I prefer that Pacquiao fight at 140. That doesn't mean he'll do it. It just means that it's a possibility. And then if Crawford's at 140, you know, I thought it was a couple of fights ago that Bob Arum was trying to get rid of the husk of Manny Pacquiao and give it to an American like Tim Bradley, who he's invested a ton of money in. I thought that's what he was trying to do, and I'm not so sure he's doing that now that he knows Pacquiao's sort of a linchpin to the China strategy. But if it looks like Pacquiao starts to fade, and Crawford can go at 140 and look good, which I think he can, because he's big enough, then, yeah, we could be talking about a Pacquiao fight before long. It's not like a lot of people have a much better argument outside of a Floyd Mayweather.
And, I mean, it's a stretch, what I'm about to say, but it's not, I don't think, that far out of the realm of possibility that, you know, if assuming this, I mean, I don't want to, like, talk down about it, but assuming this Omaha thing works out and Terrence Crawford continues winning and he can continue selling in that region, which, I mean, I guess is not really out of the question, assuming that could happen and Manny Pacquiao does start to fade and they do make that fight, that would be a hell of a switchover as far as helping to create a star out of Terrence Crawford anyway. So, yeah, there's that.
There's a slight problem with Crawford's marketability in that the most interesting thing about him are his family members and the funny dresses they wear and yell and scream from the sound. Like, he's personality-wise, he is not interesting. Maybe he could get there, and it wasn't like Pacquiao always was, but at least you could talk about Pacquiao's crazy scuba diving with the president adventure type shit. And you can't really do that with Crawford. There's not like, oh, people in Omaha like him and his family is raucous and wears funny clothing. That's about it for Crawford, and maybe he can do something about that. But he seems like a real shy, reserved, smart, you know, quiet, confident kind of guy. I don't know if he has it in him to become interesting. Maybe Top Rank can give him some kind of fake hobby. maybe he likes hunting lions in Africa and something that would just make everybody go, oh, shit, Terrence Crawford. He's that lion hunting boxer. Something.
Well, they tried doing that with I can't even remember. It might not have been Top Rank. It might have been Main Events. But with what was his name? The boxing banker, the dude who was tap dancing, and he was getting knocked out. Calvin Brock. Calvin Brock.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Man.
Maybe he can wear a beanie.
Horrible.
Maybe he can just wear a beanie. He can wear a beanie everywhere he goes. One with a propeller on the top.
That could be his thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd buy it.
Oh, that boxer with the propeller beanie? Awesome.
I'd buy that for a nickel. speaking of which, in the co-feature, Matt Korobov, of course, wound up taking a decision over, what was his name? Jose Uzcategui. It was kind of getting butchered all night long on the broadcast. It's not a very easy name to say. I'll give them that. But in any event, what did you think Matt Korobov looked like in that fight?
So I've been calling him Uzi Cat Guy, because that's kind of awesome to think about. Like a guy, like to me, like, oh, it's so awesome. He's a guy who has an Uzi shaped like a cat. Or perhaps he's a guy who has a cat who wields an Uzi. I don't know, but can we just call him Jose or something? That's totally the best possibility. Can we just call him, let's just say Jose. Jose?
Sure.
Is that his first name?
Sure.
All right, let's talk about Jose. Man, they were kind of desperately trying to make Korobov seem like a guy who could fight Golovkin soon, weren't they? Like, they really started out, like, this guy fought Golovkin in the amateurs, and he started kind of hot. He's looking like the kind of guy who could challenge Golovkin soon. So everything was really trying to prop him up as a future Golovkin opponent.
Yeah, they really name dropped Golovkin like excessively, in my opinion, and I don't really know why.
Because they're desperate to find opponents for him, and they were trying to build this guy up as a guy who could be an opponent. That seemed like what they were trying to do.
Yeah,
that's right.
Well,
history
that makes
fucking
sense,
tall. America got scored on again. America is now down 2-0. Listen,
you're 10 seconds ahead of my thing, because I actually have it on my TV, but I'm just not really watching. But
America also starts on the East Coast. This is where we came from. It took you forever to get to be part of America over there. So you should put out a note, I think. Maybe you shouldn't, because everybody's going to think you're shitting on America. America doesn't have a chance. America doesn't give up. So maybe don't say anything about the fact that they're down 2-0 and they should switch over to listening to us now. So we were talking about Jose and Matt Korobov. So Korobov did not, to me, demonstrate a clear, this guy belongs in there with GGG, but he's better than some other guys they might end up having him with. I mean, think about the people Kovalev's been in with lately. I don't think that Triple G's situation is going to be that much better if he doesn't get somebody like a Chavez or a Frotch. Was Korobov in the ballpark of somebody who could sell as a potential opponent? I guess, but he also just was so inconsistent throughout the whole fight. Like, and some of that was Jose's fault. Jose isn't bad. He's certainly showed some things. I thought what Kellerman said about it was pretty accurate for the most part, which was, by the end, after they kind of had stopped selling the notion of, like, what if this fighter, he's ready for Triple G. After they did that and made it, once Kellerman got fairly sincere about it and said it was a win that was neither great for either man, but also not bad for either man. It was, good in some ways for both dudes.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, it wasn't a total disaster, but he didn't make me clamor, certainly.
Yeah, and I don't want to make it all negative about him, because he did win, and it was against a guy who didn't really play ball in a way. I mean, he made it awkward, he made it kind of difficult for Korobov, so it wasn't like it was a terrible win or a terrible showing in any event. But at the same time, he did kind of display a few undesirable characteristics, in the sense that he looked like he was getting winded fairly early in the fight, and it was only a 10-rounder.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, every time he got hit, he just didn't really seem to like it a whole lot. Nobody likes getting hit, but, some guys seem to react better to it than others. And in this case, Korobov was kind of just, when he was getting hit, it was almost like it was freezing up his offense and everything, and that was about it. So, in any event, I just don't know how confident I would be if I were Korobov's handlers pushing him forward very quickly against Gennady Golovkin, unless they're really trying to kind of cash him out. But then again, if I'm not mistaken, he's what, like 32 or something like that? 31, 32?
Yeah, I think that's a big problem. He's been around in the pro game longer than he should have in terms of step-up fights. He was a guy who had so much hype coming out of the Olympics, and he has not lived up to any of it. He's had moments where he's looked really awesome. I mean, when he decked Jose twice, it was pretty good. And he's had fights where he just did some kind of crazy thing where you're like, holy shit, this guy can do these wonderful things. But I don't know, you know, I've not read anything about his camp or his team that have pointed to, like, why is he so inconsistent? Not just like he was in this one fight, but from fight to fight. He's just never put it together for any stretch of time of any significance other than when he first came out of the pros, and then, of course, what does that mean?
Yeah, as the level of opposition seems to have gotten higher. Well, initially he looked good, and for example, who was it that he totally leveled? It was like, I think it was Aussie Duran, and he has had some moments where he looked really good, but they've been kind of few and far between. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't really know what to think about him. And I guess if they do try to build him towards a Golovkin type of fight, yeah, they are really running short on opponents or prospective opponents for Golovkin, which is a shame.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the real sad things about the way boxing is being run lately is that we have a number of pretty spectacular talents, you know, really, really thrilling to watch, like Kovalev, like Golovkin, like Stevenson at times, and we're just not going to get the best fights for any of those guys. It's, you know, we might get some good ones, you know, with, I think Golovkin, there's still some hope because, you know, who knows what Frotch wants to do. There might still be some hope, you know, with Ward eventually. There's the options that can be made without there being the bullshit about, hey, America scored again. America scored for the first time. The options that could be made are not they're still there. It's not like with Stevenson or it's not like with Kovalev where there's very little that you could do unless Andre Ward decides suddenly he wants to be a 175-pounder. And there's no sign that he has decided that he wants to do that. So it's not completely hopeless, but we are in this period of stagnation with some of these really awesome exciting and good performers is one of the saddest things that's going on right now.
And it's really a disservice to the fighters at the end of the day. I mean, you can talk about, you know, so-and-so is good for the sport, or this is creating good fights for the sport, or blah, blah, blah. Maybe short-term, but at the end of the day, it's really a disservice to the fighters because it's stunting their potential, bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass. But as far as Korobov goes, I guess, how far is he going to get middleweight? What would you expect from him at middleweight, or, I don't know, let's say 2015, they actually do kind of point him towards Golovkin. What do you think happens?
I think he gets smashed the way Golovkin smashes everything in his path.
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I could see him contending with some bottom top 10 of the division kind of guys. Maybe. But it all just depends on, you know, is the guy who can be awesome, does he show up? Holy cap. Oh, sorry, they almost scored again. Should I stop doing that? Is that really annoying? You should tell me if it's really annoying.
No, I don't care. No, it doesn't matter.
All right.
I'm good. I'm actually hearing like my neighbors and like houses down yelling and screaming and stuff like that. So it's all good.
If I'm thinking about him against somebody like, oh, I don't know, Martin Murray, is that kind of interesting to me? Yeah, kind of. Do I give him a great chance against, you know, some of those guys? Not really. It's just, you know, I don't give him a bad chance because of his inconsistency. He is also prone to good things on the upside of the inconsistent. But no, he's not doing a whole lot for me, because for every good we get something terrible or just plain lame. So he doesn't enthuse me much.
Well, I guess one thing that actually could work to his favor, in a way, is that I guess I should say it somewhat carefully, but I was going to say the title picture at middleweight is kind of muddy, but it's not. Miguel Cotto is the middleweight champion, and there's no question about it. However, the belt picture, and a lot of the time that is what has been driving television dates, the way that television dates are being given out. And so in that sense, that actually could work to Korobov's favor. Now, that obviously passed Golovkin. I wouldn't give him much of a shot against Golovkin either, but if he were to take some other type of roundabout way, he might be able to stick around and avoid, or maybe not even so much avoid, but stick around without ever having to fight a Cotto or Golovkin or somebody on a similar level, but still kind of get the belt, you know what I mean? And in a way, that's an indictment.
Yeah.
That's not a good thing of these belts.
No, I agree with that. And it's unfortunately also something of an indictment of how the networks overvalue them, in my opinion.
Yeah.
There's so many good fights that happen where there's no belt on the line. And I think that, you know, that also goes for you can say the same thing about any kind of belt, even including the sort of the way we do the championship thing at Tribub. You know, a good fight isn't always a fight that has a belt attached. And the notion that fans can be suckered into, oh, this fight is for the middleweight championship of the world, when everybody who is much of a fan knows that's not true. It's unfortunate that the HBOs and Showtimes exploit that the way they do. I feel like there's been a little bit of, you know, for as much as Espinoza at Showtime can be a bit annoying on the old Twitter, he has recently sassed-mouthed some fans who have said, oh, a belt makes a fight good. There are lots of things that make a fight good, like we were talking about earlier. But as far as Korobov and getting a belt, he was what? They were talking about Pierre Quillen? I mean, I don't even think that can – maybe that can happen, depending on what the Heyman Golden Boy situation is. But does that do anything for you? It doesn't do anything for me.
Not really.
It's not any more – I guess it's more interesting than a lot of what Quillen has been up to lately. But that's a damnation of Quillen as much as anything else.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, the situation – well, I don't know. Steven Espinoza is the type of guy that every so often he delivers a pretty funny line or like a gem that has me cracking up, but the rest of the time I really think he comes off like a flopping douchebag. But that's just me, and, you know, I'm not really interested in, like, getting into it with him over, especially things like that, when really the only response that he has to say about these things are whatever, or, you know, things that amount to, like, you know, I'm here and you're not, you know, stuff like that. So I do think that it's really lame the way that even this HBO broadcast this last weekend, I can't remember offhand what fight it was, but there was a fight coming up on their schedule that they mentioned, and the way that they sold it on air, you know, the way that they announced it on air was the blah, blah, blah championship, even though it was for like a WBO belt that had in no way, shape or form anything to do with the actual championship of that division. And I'm kind of just thinking to myself, look, I know that they have to sell it a certain way on air. I get that. And I know that they kind of have to play ball on, you know, on some level, but at the same, and, you know, maybe that's why they got rid of Larry Merchant, because Larry Merchant got to be a little bit cantankerous and stopped giving a fuck about those type of things. But at the same time, it's like, you know, these guys, like, I know Jim Lampley's not an idiot. I know Max Kellerman's not an idiot, yet they're still going along with that kind of company line of like, this is for the blah, blah, blah championship of the world. And I'm just like, fuck, man, come on. We need your help here. Come on, guys, help us out here.
Yeah. Totally, and it's interesting. Anyway. Kellerman, you know, Kellerman was on board with the ring belt for a while, so he would talk that up, and I don't know if he's feeling burned or whatever, but I couldn't blame him if he was. The guy who I did a piece for Awful Announcing where we talked to Brian Kinney, and Brian Kinney had made a point for much of his broadcasting career of saying, this is for a belt, it is not for the championship. And he hasn't done that quite as much while at Showtime, although he did it the other night, where he made a pretty explicit point of saying, okay, he is a belt holder. So, you know, occasionally there will be some people who will clarify it for us, but a lot of times they seem to just go along with it, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's just kind of frustrating, and I wish that a couple more prominent broadcasters, commentators, et cetera, would stand up in the face of that type of stuff, because, you know, I understand that in some of situations there's kind of confusion as to who the best is or who such and such is or how much of this win should be worth, et cetera, et cetera. I get that, and that's just kind of the nature of boxing. But in other cases, there are clear champions in divisions, and they're kind of like ignored in favor of selling the fight because it has a belt attached to it, and that's lame. Anyway, to kind of try to rope us back in a tiny bit, as far as Jose, I can't even like get it out now, of course. Jose Uscat.
Let's say Jose. It's okay.
Yeah. Jose, how far do you think that he can get? I mean, to me, and I ask this honestly, and I don't mean it as a joke, because he did kind of also show some flashes of being able to adjust in there against Korobov. You know, he kind of turned the heat on a few different times when he really needed to. Part of what he seemed to lack was a whole lot of punching power, but also on top of that, the technique was not very good. You know, maybe that's the type of thing where he's been fighting a while and this is unlikely to change because he's not a young dude, but, you know,
well,
I don't know, just for fun.
He is fairly young. I think he's just 23.
Oh, well, for whatever reason, there's kind of a buzz when you're talking. Maybe I'll try moving. But in any event, maybe he's been fighting since he was like 12 or something like that, and so his style is unlikely to challenge or change. But in any event, do you see anything from him just for fun?
I do. I think there's room there for him to do something.
I'm not entirely sure why, but your audio for me is just like buzzing like crazy, and I can barely understand anything you're saying. Let me see if you don't mind. Do you mind calling back in? Hanging up and calling back in?
No, I don't mind.
Yeah, I'll call back in.
All right. I'll stay here and bullshit for a second.
Okay.
All right, thanks. It sounded like, I'm not entirely sure if everybody else was getting that same audio. There was quite a funky buzz when Tim was talking, but it sounded like he was saying that he didn't really see anything special as far as talent goes or anything like that with Uskategi, which I would basically agree with. But I do think that especially with the, I don't know, kind of the hype surrounding Korobov going in, and let me patch Tim back in here. Tim, do you hear me?
I do. How buzzy am I?
Oh, that is way better. That was, yeah, okay. It started getting just like straight up robotic. It was kind of scaring me. But it sounded like you were saying that you didn't really see anything particular about Uskategi as far as like his talent or anything special about him. And I was just mentioning that I didn't really either. It was just that I thought that, I don't know, considering the hype behind Korobov going in and the fact that he's got this, you know, big amateur blah, 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 you know, the fact that Uskategi actually had a couple moments was, yeah, it was impressive, I guess.
No, before my audio got all funky and cut out, I was saying he did show some character in coming back from those knockdowns, and that says something about, you know, whether he can build on what he has. You know, I didn't see sky high, you know, potential of this guy's going to take over the sport or anything. I saw a few things that were pretty good, and I also saw the character that can be a building block for him, you know, at age 23 coming back and you know, improving on what he didn't do right. So I wouldn't count him out. I also, what does his nickname mean? Bolivita?
To be honest, I really don't know.
I was hoping it meant like Little Bolivia. Because of my favorite rap lyric, one of my favorite rap lyrics of all time. I don't know if you ever heard the Willie D solo album that he did when he wasn't with the Ghetto Boys. And he had a line where he was rapping back and forth with a woman that he was having that he was talking like some dirty sex talk with, and her opening line was, "Good loving's what I'll be giving you. I got a pussy about the size of Bolivia."
Nice.
Which is like, Bolivia is maybe small for a country, but it's kind of big for a vagina.
That is true. And also on top of that, just to kind of add to the Bolivia mysticism, Mike Tyson also said that he was going to fade to Bolivian. So that just kind of adds to the, yeah, this just brings it to legendary status, really. And for a vagina,
nope.
Legendary might
for
not
a
be
vagina.
Here.
No. Well, it depends on what kind of legend. Yeah, if we're talking about like Paul Bunyan, no.
True.
No.
Not good. But I really have no idea what that name means, although that was a clever anecdote. Thank you.
Hey, you're welcome. It's the least I can do.
Well, that basically kind of wraps up the, like, at least for the next week or so, boxing talk anyway. And so I wanted to, if you have time, kind of get your thoughts on Saul Canelo Alvarez versus Arislandi Lala, which is coming up in a couple weeks here. And I would have to say that that's a fight that most of us are looking forward to. What do you think? Are you looking forward to it?
Yeah, I think last time we talked on the air when you had me, you would ask what's the fight that everybody's looking forward to the most, and we all said Canelo Lara. I mean, that fight is really intriguing because why in the hell would Canelo take that fight? Other than just that's kind of a badass thing to do, and you got to admire the gumption of the kid to take a fight like that. I guess there's some gumption in taking on a Mayweather too, but the gumption is a lot easier to have when there's an enormous paycheck on the other end. And this is a fight that that he didn't have to have in order to make big money. So I love that he's doing it. I liked when he did it with Austin Trout too, actually. That was another risky fight with no obvious, he could make a lot of money if he fought him outside of just being Canelo and making a lot of money for fighting anybody. I love the fight. I'm really into the fight. And I don't know how, we were talking about what fights were competitive or not competitive. I think there's a chance that Canelo's gotten too good. And Lara has been inconsistent. He's had moments where he's looked spectacular, and he's had moments where he hasn't. I guess I would have to bet on him looking spectacular for the fight of his life, for the biggest fight he could possibly be in. But there's a chance that this is not as dangerous a fight as it looks, depending on what version of Lara shows up, because Canelo has been consistent. Just short of, the losing to Mayweather as one-sidedly as he did, he has put in pretty consistent performances. We know who he is now. We know what he can do. And he's less of a variable. The real variable is Lara.
It's funny because Foley is always giving me shit because I use my wife, who is Mexican, as kind of like her family is like a barometer. I apply everything that happens in our discussions of anything remotely, involving boxing with her family. I apply that to like the whole country of Mexico, basically. But it's funny because my wife's family, even before the Mayweather fight, everyone was going like, "Ah, pinche Canelo. Like everybody was like seriously rooting hardcore for him. But it was like the same thing with like the Mexico World Cup team. They were rooting hardcore for him, but they're like, "Nah, they're going to lose the whole time." And it was and it was hilarious because then Canelo did lose. And they're like, he was robbed, come on, he was robbed, which is exactly the same thing that happened with the World Cup game. So, it's just it's so funny because that dynamic and that type of support behind Canelo, it still lends to a lot of money backing him up. And I think that could be a big factor in who winds up winning this fight. I wound up mentioning that at some point to Foley last week. But I do think that the fact that Canelo seems to have the money, he does have the money behind him, the rest of the matchup being somewhat equal, I think that you do bring up a good point about Canelo being more consistent and also consistently getting better But mm-hmm. all of the other kind of stuff being equal or more difficult to figure out, that kind of money push and popularity push could be a difference if it winds up going to the cards. I mean, needless to say.
Yes, unfortunately, needless to say. Is there a transitive property? Do you acquire Mexicanness by being married to a Mexican? Do you have to eat certain things, or does she have to bestow on you a certain number of kisses, or do you just acquire wisdom of Mexicanness from her?
I think that it's kind of a complicated sort of osmosis, really. But every so often I'll do something like, for example, when my wife makes like tacos, which she does often and is kind of stereotypical, I know, but delicious. She'll make tacos and I'll eat them standing up. And she says, like, now you're eating like a Mexican. And I'm like, I don't even know what the fuck that means. Just because I'm eating standing up. And she's like, yeah, that's like, we always do that. We always eat standing up. I'm like, oh, okay. I think that's good for you, by the way. But, yeah, it's just funny things like that. So apparently I just picked it up somewhere along the way.
Good. Good work.
Yeah.
So
in other words, I'm rooting for Canelo.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that the Angulo we got against Canelo wasn't the Angulo that we got against Lara, and I know that styles make fights. But you know, my opinion of Canelo has been steadily rising since the first time I saw him and was convinced he was fucking terrible. I was just of the mind that he was no good at all, and other people saw good things in him, and I was like, what are you looking at? This guy can't fight. He's slower than any other fighter that is alive. The only guy he was faster than was Carlos Valdemir, an old Carlos Valdemir. And I was freaking out. I was like, this guy's no good. He's never going anywhere. He's got a name and he's got a look, and you know, I just didn't believe in him. But he's gotten better in every single way. And Lara is not old, but he's getting older, and he's been inconsistent. So I really like Canelo in the fight, but it's such a dangerous fight. In principle, that you can't help but love the fact that it's happening.
And they do actually have a couple of common opponents too, which I, you know, when I'd kind of emailed you some of the things that I'd want to talk about, I think I touched on that, but Alfredo Angulo for one, and also Austin Trout. And so as far as their common opponents go, I mean, it's kind of a toss-up, really, because Edislam
yeah.
really, really struggled with Alfredo Angulo. You know, and, I mean, he wound up winning, of course, and he wound up beating the crap out of Angulo's eye. But, you know, he had some serious struggles there and was hurt. Yet, you know, Canelo basically had his way with an Angulo who perhaps didn't really look like himself but had his way regardless. And then, on the other hand, Edislam pretty much looked like a million bucks as well. You know, not very entertaining, but as far as the quality with which he won, looked all very good against Austin Trout. Yet Austin Trout, at least on my card, gave Canelo a whole lot of shit and stylistically was an issue for him for much of the fight. So it's kind of like,
yeah.
You know, pick and choose. In your opinion, what do you think means more as far as this fight goes?
I'm so daft. I completely, for some reason, my brain wasn't working right, and I wasn't putting two and two together with the Austin Trout-Lara situation, because clearly they both got worse versions of the one than the one that they looked good against. So, you know, Austin Trout was better against Canelo than he was against Lara. And Angulo was better against Lara than he was against Canelo. So maybe we can't read too much into it. In terms of style, maybe it's a little more instructive what happened with Trout. Well, actually, you know what? It kind of lines up really neatly in the sense that, you know, Canelo out-punched a puncher and Lara outboxed a boxer, and that they both struggled with the opposite kind of style. Now, I think, you know, I wouldn't want to confine Lara to just a boxer, and I wouldn't want to confine Canelo to just a brawler, because they both have, you know, they both have serious power. They both have good boxing ability. But it does point to the ways in which they could receive trouble from the other, which is yet another dimension of why that fight is sexy.
Well, and it also kind of brings an element of, I also believe I brought this up, but it kind of also allows me to bring in this Transnational Boxing Rankings Board once more to the discussion, because it is involved. As far as Floyd Mayweather goes, many would still consider Floyd Mayweather the best junior middleweight in the world. I mean, it's kind of fuzzy. It's really tough to say. Is he a welterweight? Is he a junior middleweight? I don't even really know. I don't really even know what the time limit is as far as having to defend your belt, you know, and these things are kind of, it's kind of shaky to really pinpoint what these things are. But at the same time, what does this whole Canelo Lara situation say about Floyd Mayweather, you know, in terms of the junior middleweight division? I mean, are these two the two best junior middleweights fighting, basically, since Floyd is at welterweight? What's going to happen to the championship if you know, they consider Floyd Mayweather the best junior middleweight, blah, blah, blah? And also, finally, which is kind of the tail end of that, does the winner of this fight have a really good shot at Floyd in 2015?
Yeah, so I think...
That's a long question, you know, I know. I'm sorry.
It is. I'm going to try to give you a not as long answer. The thing about Floyd, of course, is that he's more welterweight than junior middleweight, probably. But he has not ruled out the possibility that he'll return to junior middleweight. And I think before the board said he's not the junior middleweight champion anymore, we would need to see something pretty definitive on that account, because we don't like the idea of stripping people. So that's part one for him. I suppose it could drag out and get pretty awkward. There was a decision that Ring had to make after a while where Marquez was the lightweight champion for so freaking long, but hadn't fought there in, you know, half a dozen fights or something ridiculous. And they finally said, well, look, he is effectively abdicated. And I was fine with that, but we haven't really encountered that on the board, and I think that would have to be something we'd have to discuss before I got ahead of saying what we would do if
sure.
Mayweather just sort of never relinquished or never gave a clear indication. The other thing that's a little convenient with Lara and Alvarez is that they're fighting at 155 for whatever reason. I think Canelo's probably not a junior middleweight for much longer. He seems to like the idea of moving up to 160. He seemed to have trouble getting down for his last couple fights to weights that he needed to get down to. So, you know, that becomes less awkward if he leaves. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where there's no perfect solution to any of this. And I wouldn't want to represent to anyone that there was perfection to be had in any system. There are pros and cons to both kinds of championship policies, and I happen to think that the pros for the one champion lineal far outweigh the other option, where everybody can just get a belt from anybody they want and the sanctioning organizations do shady shit. I think that the advantages for the sport and for the fighters far outweigh the negatives for the fans. I think it's just way better. That doesn't mean there aren't awkward situations where you have a guy who is the champion at 160 who may not really be a 160-pounder, and you have a guy at 154 who is the champion who may not really be a 154-pounder, and you end up with awkward scenarios where it's like, God, what if Cotto fights Tim Bradley at 156 and Bradley beats him?
I really
so
don't
weird.
Want to see that. I even like Tim Bradley,
either.
But I don't want to see that.
I don't either, and I think more likely than not, Bradley loses that fight just on size. But at the same time, you know, I don't like the idea of it. It's not great to think about it. And you know, Cotto's team is saying they don't think it's likely either. So that's kind of good news. But these are potentially awkward scenarios that, you know, might make people think, well, God, that makes the catchweight, that makes the lineal belts and the one champion bad. No. It's just a pros and cons situation where the pros still outweigh the cons in my mind.
Well, and on top of that, I've said this in various kind of like, you know, Twitter discussions and other discussions otherwise. But I, in my opinion, and you know, I could wind up being proven wrong, but over the long haul, in most of these situations. And this is something that is not new either, because especially when, well, I don't get too convolutedly, you know, far into the history of all the titles and everything, but when the, you know, NBA wound up splitting, when it, NBA belts were considered important over New York State Athletic Commission belts and vice versa and blah, blah, blah. You know, there's been conflict a lot of the time in the history of boxing. However, over the long haul, as time goes by, these things tend to get ironed out. The cream tends to rise to the top. You know, the best fighters tend to stick around longer. You know, and it's not very easy to fake the funk, as it were, for very long.
Absolutely. And, you know, people, when we first started, one of the things that was in the awkward category for us was we said strictly number one versus number two, which meant that we didn't acknowledge Vladimir Klitschko as the champion. Well, guess what happened? It worked out. He fought the number two finally after his brother kind of had retired and he had been on such a long hiatus that he effectively retired and everybody knew he was about to retire. It worked out, and now Klitschko's the champion, and it's like you said, we trust that the good fighters will become champions if the system is conducive to that.
Well, let me go ahead and affirm that, yes, Klitschko has indeed fought number two all his career. But I waited a little too long for the rim shot there. But these situations really do over the long haul. I mean, it can be awkward. It can be really confusing. There can be a lot of stupid things that happen in the meantime, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, over the long haul, it generally does wind up making sense because, as I said, it would be, for example, the people who say, oh, Floyd Mayweather's never done anything. You don't really, even if he had fought crappy opposition his entire career, you don't get to be undefeated in 48 fights or whatever, being shitty. You know what I mean? It just doesn't happen. Boxing isn't that way. In any event, I do think that it does kind of raise some interesting questions as far as, I mean, there are going to be detractors either way, but I'd have to say that after however many decades of sanctioning bodies and people who are charging fighters to fight, I just don't really see why we need belts anymore a lot of the time, because it should be very clear that when one guy beats another, there doesn't need to be a physical belt between them to know who won. In any event, it does kind of raise these interesting, ideas or these interesting arguments anyway.
It does, and I'm fine with the arguments. I'm happy to have the arguments. The people who are trying to sell you as you know, this is perfection are the people you probably shouldn't trust. This isn't just me marketing it. This is me being realistic and looking at how it works and saying there will be times where this is not ideal. There will be times where people might say, you know, there's a reason that that so many belts came around. There was a void in the argument of what made a champion that people wanted to fill and answer, and it created more problems than it solved, in my opinion.
I don't think there's any question, really. I mean, I don't know. It's not exactly like these belts haven't been good in some ways. Like you said, there's advantages both ways. But I'd have to say that, you know, just following this guy beat this guy's standard is a little bit less convoluted, I'd have to say. But that's just me.
I think for people who I think have been boxing fans for a long time and are just kind of used to it, I think that they just sort of accept it as the way it is, and that if you're going against it, that it means it'll be bad. There seems to be a sort of reflexive, this is what I know, that, you know, not that they're dumb or that they're, you know, haven't thought it through, just that when you're raised on a certain kind of system, you can sometimes be supportive of it reflexively. And if you talk to people long enough, and you make the case and you do a good enough job of doing what you're supposed to as a rankings organization, that doesn't do the kinds of things that the sanctioning outfits do, hopefully that over time will also win over people, and they'll see that it doesn't have to be the way that we know, and that you can try to talk to them about the pros and cons and win them over to the argument, and, you know, maybe someday things change. It's nice that they've moved as well as they have. when you've seen, you know, things like Teddy Atlas getting on board like he has. Maybe there's another shoe that drops one of these days. And then there's more movement in the right direction. It's a long fight. It's not going to change overnight.
Yeah, there's no question. You're talking about battling however many decades of institutionalized. And, I mean, I don't want to say that it is all 100% been corruption. And that's the type of thing that a lot of people, especially folks like me who were always, you know, researching and doing history type of stuff, you know, it's a generalization that we make that is often true, you know, about boxing being corrupt and, you know, dirty and kind of like merciless and blood, you know, bloodlusty and all these types of things. And it's generally true, but not always. But yeah, it's, you're battling however many years of this institution, you know, and that's not going to happen overnight. And I would have to say over the course of a fairly short period of time, there have been some fairly serious advances made with the transnational boxing rankings, rankings board. So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
But bringing it back to Canelo Lara, if I could, as far as this pay-per-view goes, as far as the actual pay-per-view goes, I think that that's also important to talk about in the sense that it doesn't really seem to be a very high-quality pay-per-view aside from the main event. Well, it's just not. It's not a high-quality pay-per-view aside from the main event. We have Abner Mares not fighting Johnny Gonzalez. He's fighting Jonathan Oquendo and some in a 10-rounder, and then I think it's Juanma Lopez fighting Vargas. Who else? Mauricio Herrera fighting Johan Perez, which is good that he's getting another shot and everything, except for it's not against Danny Garcia. So, I mean, at some point, I just have to ask, is Canelo versus Arismendi Lara the type of main event that can really carry a pay-per-view?
Yeah, I mean, with the Canelo-Angulo thing, one of the things you had going for it was Mexican versus Mexican. And not just that, but two different kinds of fighters who could move different kinds of Mexican fans. I mean, the Mexican fans were entertainingly divided on that, you know, with certain people saying, you know, Angulo is the real Mexican, and he's, you know, some of the stuff you used to see with Oscar De La Hoya when he would fight a fellow Mexican. Not quite as bad as that, but, you know, you would see some of that, and that kind of conflict can draw fans, and they played up to that during the promotion. I don't know. The main selling point for Lara is the danger element, and that can move pay-per-view units. It really can. You know, one of the reasons that the Canelo Mayweather fight was so big wasn't just because Canelo was a big name. It was because there were people who believed, rightly or wrongly, that Mayweather was in danger in a way that he usually wasn't. So that matters. But outside of that, you don't have much. You know, Lara is not a guy who has a huge fan base of his own, and that's from the standpoint of what could happen in terms of pay-per-view buys. That's a problem. And then the undercard being just, you know, really terrible. Some names, yes, but terrible undercard fights, compounded by the fact that everybody is on pay-per-view this year, which, you know, Bob Arum was talking about it recently. He was griping about how, gosh darn it, you know, Miguel Cotto versus Sergio Martinez at New World because there have been too many pay-per-view fights. By the way, Miguel Cotto's next fight is going to be on pay-per-view. This kind of thing happens so much.
Probably
that
against the guy,
it
not
drives you
division.
Insane. Yes, also that. So I don't. It's like boxing knows how screwy it is sometimes. It sees how messed up it is, but it doesn't do anything about it. And I think there's a chance that this fight, you know, maybe because Canelo's still so kind of new as a big, big attraction to people, that he'll be a little insulated against something like a Cotto Martinez fight where people weren't as 100% into the matchup. I don't know. There's a chance, but the trends of Lara not being having a big constituency, no built-in fan base, you know, the bad undercard and way too many pay-per-views, I think there could be problems.
Yeah, in other words, I think what you're saying and what I agree with is that we might get some decent numbers, but don't expect anything all that impressive.
I agree with that. Yeah, that's basically what I'm saying. I agree. I sort of roundabout agree with you agreeing with me, which means I agree with myself in a sort of roundabout sort of way.
Oh, nice. So who are you picking then? Let's lay it on the line.
Canelo. I like Canelo
boom.
Right now. I always reserve the right to change my point of view on this on Fight Week because I haven't watched these guys in depth and started breaking them down about, you know, whose punches work well against whom. You know, haven't started comparing them as closely as I will. But right now I really like Canelo. You?
I tend to agree. I mean, I think that when the matchup was first made, the combination of me being
kind of an Edis Lendi Lara fan, but also just kind of like looking at the style matchup, I think that those two things put together had me going, nope, Lara's going to beat him. This is going to be bad. But the closer the fight gets, I mean, it's not that I don't have much confidence in Lara anymore. It's just that, I don't know. I kind of think that there are a handful of things just tipping towards Canelo's way. Like, I think that the hand speed difference maybe won't be as big as I thought. And on top of that, mm-hmm. Canelo's big enough that I – big enough, and also he's careful but not so careful that getting hit is going to deter him too much, I think. And it's, mm-hmm. on top of that, a totally different style from Floyd Mayweather. Yeah, so I think that at some point Canelo's probably going to wind up catching up. That's my guess, and that we've already seen what happens when guys catch up to Edis Lendi Lara, and that is he can be caught and he can be hurt. So that's just kind of my reasoning anyway, but I tend to agree. I think that it's going to be a close fight, but I lean towards Saul Canelo Alvarez.
I think, you know, another thing I bet Canelo has learned a lesson from the way he fought against Mayweather. I mean, he was too tentative. Again, some of that is Mayweather's fault because that he does that to people. But he came out so gangbusters against Angulo so fearlessly that I think he probably will do that again. Maybe not, you know, maybe not reckless per se, but he'll realize, I think, that he doesn't want to box with a boxer. I think he'll realize he wants to smash. He'll have to smash this guy and put some volume on him. And there's some risk of, you know, with Lara being a good counterpuncher, there's some risk of that really backfiring. And he, you know, he seems to have better one punch power than Angulo, so it could backfire times two. But, you know, I still think that if Canelo puts pressure on Lara, intelligent pressure like he's capable of, Lara's going to be in trouble. Maybe not quickly. But over time, I think it'll start to really accumulate, and he'll be the man.
Yeah, and excuse me, I think that you also bring up a good point there about the danger of bringing the fight to Lara like he did against Angulo. I mean, I think that the speed, especially the hand speed disparity there between Canelo and Angulo, was so big that he could just kind of afford to get into that type of fight with him. And on top of that, you know, as we mentioned before, Angulo just didn't really look very good. So, you know, the combination of these things means that Canelo, at least to me, is probably going to be a little bit more careful than he was in that fight. In that fight, he was a little bit reckless at times, which worked just fine for him, given the situation. But you also brought up the Floyd Mayweather fight, which gives me a nice segue into the fact that this morning it was announced that Floyd Mayweather is going to be taking on Marcos Maidana again in a rematch. And, you know, I had some other little subjects that I had, you know, thought about bringing up and mentioning, but of course this is probably the biggest news of today. So what is your reaction to that rematch being made, Timothy Starks?
So it looks like, I mean, it feels like that's what's probably going to happen, but it's not official yet, right? I mean, it seems like 1,000%. Yeah, I need 1,000, but no, I'll still talk about it as though it's real. Also, I got this news release from TMZ, and I haven't clicked on the video, but when did I get this? About 2 hours ago. Floyd Mayweather Jr., Justin Bieber's my man crush. So that's something that I need to get to the bottom of. I mean, if he actually is saying that Justin Bieber is his man crush, I think we have cause to doubt that he does not mean it when he says he'll fight Marcos Maidana. But no, I think that's the most likely fight, and it's the fight that makes the most sense right now, you know, in the world that we live in, not the fight that makes the most pure sense, because that's not that fight. But it's the fight that makes the most sense for right now. What I'm really curious about is what's his surprise that he's got in store for May. Did you see him say that too? That he would have a surprise in store for May.
No.
Okay. So whatever it is, I'm just gonna make fun of Floyd Mayweather for a little while. He was at the BET Awards and his kids, like, got in a car crash and he sent Justin Bieber to go help them. Meanwhile, he's at the BET Awards and who was it? Oh, it was 2 Chainz was offering to people to that he was saying if I get 5,000 retweets on this, I will punch Mayweather in the back of the head. And I would like to find out whether he got over the limit. He clearly probably didn't punch him in the head. But
okay, I know what you're talking about now. I remember seeing this.
It was 2 Chainz. Was it 2 Chainz?
I don't know who it was. I just saw like a screenshot, like somebody had posted the back of Floyd's head. You know, and I mean, I just don't really follow like the BET Awards. The only reason why I would have even known that they were on is because somebody was talking about them on Twitter, you know. So I saw somebody retweet a picture, like a screenshot of some. It might have been, I don't know, but I barely even know who the fuck 2 Chainz is. But anyway, somebody had tweeted a picture saying, if I get blah, blah, blah retweets, then I'm going to punch Floyd in the back of the head or some shit like that. And the response was, man, you already got twice that. Have you punched him yet? Or something like that. I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Oh wait, yeah, no, it was a guy. Sorry, was it 2 Chainz? It wasn't 2 Chainz himself. Was it officially 2 Chainz? He's not got the check mark. Yeah.
I don't trust it.
I don't trust that it's actually 2 Chainz.
Yeah, we don't even know how many chains that person has.
This guy might just have one chain. Oh, here's another thing. I'm sorry. I'm using the radio show as a, like sort of a problem solver. Of everything that I want to know about in the world, and if people could tell me in the song where 2 Chainz says 2 Chainz, 4 bracelets, can someone tell me what he means by that 4 bracelets? I don't know what he's talking about with 4 bracelets. I get with 2 Chainz because he's got 2 chains on his neck. What is the significance of 4 bracelets? I'm throwing that out there to the listeners. If you could solve that for me while we're on this issue, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm stumped. The only thing I can think of is that part in the Chappelle show where Rick James says, I wish I had 2 more hands so I can give those titties 4 thumbs down. That's the only thing I can think
of.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's well said.
That's
done.
All I can think of. Well, you know, apart from this whole BET fiasco, I mean, as far as this Maidana thing goes, I think that it probably is the best option for Floyd right now. And I mean, I don't really know that there was enough malcontent or enough of a outcry over the first Maidana fight that it would make it, you know, just to do the fight for me. I mean, I know that it had a lot of hype to it, and there were a lot of people going, oh, damn, Marcos Maidana did him worse than anybody has in years, and blah, blah, blah. And while that might have been true, at the same time, I thought that Floyd won pretty clearly. So the question in my mind now is there anything, is there any factor that could make this second fight closer? Is there any other factor that, aside from just, you know, kind of not really having any other option, makes this fight attractive?
God, you really sold it, didn't you?
yes, I did.
I think you're right on point, though. I think that's part of it. And then the only other part is like tick, 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 which is just clock. And Floyd getting a little older. You know, I don't know that I don't want to get too conspiratorial or anything, but there have been some changes in the camp of Marcos Maidana. I'll just leave it at that, I guess. I feel shady even saying that, but that's worth considering. Whatever you think of Alex Ariza, he was affiliated with Maidana, and now he's not. I don't know if that means that Maidana is better or worse off. That's a factor. Maybe Maidana could somehow maybe be even more energetic, but I find that hard to believe, too. And I feel like Mayweather has a pretty good history of adjusting to when fighters give him some trouble, which he did slowly over the course of that fight, and then will probably start off that way. He's also probably going to have better, you know, he's going to spend so much time between then and now whining about the refereeing of the previous fight that, you know, it's going to be hard for Maidana to get away with some of the roughhousing that we saw from him in the first fight that actually helped. So that's something of a problem too. It seems like all things point to probably not more competitive, yet somehow still the best possible fight, possible being the key word, in this dysfunctional sport of ours.
Yep, I think that you pretty much nailed it there. And by the way, our miscreant friend, Mr. Swain here, says that you sound shady. I think he's drunk.
Swain has been pretty entertaining. In one ear, I've got you saying things that I need to concentrate on, and then in the other, one of my eyeballs keeps going to Matt Swain heckling me, which is entertaining, but also it hurts my concentration. I am not being shady, and if you want to talk to me mano a mano, Swain, instead of run into Patrick talking shit behind my back, then we can do this. But instead, you're all coming around. I'm going to punch you in the back of the head, Swain. I don't even need 5,000 retweets.
Hashtag scribe beef.
He's going to get it.
Yep. You're going to slap that. No, no.
Oh, no, I'm not going there. I refuse.
No. Nope, we're not doing it. But, okay, so I do have to kind of ask, because this is some of the other news that's been going on in the last few weeks, really, but then, of course, it's ramped up in the last few days with Golden Boy and Oscar De La Hoya. So, you know, if we believe everything that we're reading here, it seems as though Oscar De La Hoya is attempting to wrest control of Golden Boy Promotions. Now that Richard Schaefer has left, been fired, resigned, whatever it was that really happened, is this going to make any difference? If it does make a difference, is it going to be good? I mean, Oscar is such a goofball. I don't even know what to think of the guy half the time, because this entire, you know, 10 years or whatever that Golden Boy has really been around and been a force, he really has been kind of more in the background if he hasn't really been just totally making an ass out of himself. So what does this mean? Is it going to have any effect? What's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to sort of settle in for sort of a nuclear winter here, because we're eating the scraps, the things that the fights that we didn't expect to be that good are the ones where we're getting the most entertainment, or we're having to live off, you know, the periphery of fights that aren't televised on HBO or Showtime. There are plenty of good fights that aren't like that, but that's one of the things we're going to have to live with, I think, because I don't see how the sheer volume of Heyman fighters that are tied up and the sheer number of them who have a status that is at best ambiguous, who are also signed with Golden Boy, you know, and there's a $50 million case that's going between Golden Boy and Schaefer, and you know, there's so many fighters who we don't know who they can fight, on what network they'll fight on, it's impossible for me to judge what can get done. I am going to assume that little can or will get done. That's my going forward assumption, that it's going to be a rough period here. Oscar's not completely alone. I just forgot the name of his matchmaker, but you know, there have been some people who have been leaving. Golden Boy. Like, you know, there was a deputy that had left. Oh, sorry, Eric Gomez is who I was thinking of.
Yeah, Eric Gomez.
And he's still with Golden Boy.
Right?
Yeah, and Eric does good matchmaking. You know, I don't think his reputation is solid in the business. So it's not like the company is going to be in tatters where, like, you know, Oscar is at the till and he's trying to, you know, do a stick shift on a car where it's automatic transmission. It's not like, you know, that's going to be one of those kind of situations where a guy who has no freaking clue what he's doing and is just too goofy to do anything is going to be doing it all alone. So that, I guess that could give you a little bit of confidence, but not much. I'm preparing for the worst.
Yeah, I'd have to say that not only is that what's likely, that's kind of, as you said, what we've been getting. You know, these good fights that we've gotten have been fights that we didn't expect to be good, and it's kind of like, yeah, I'm almost wary of showing too much enthusiasm for them because I'm afraid that if I show too much enthusiasm for them, then these guys like Steven Espinoza will see, not like they're paying attention to me personally, but they might see, you know, this sentiment out there and go, oh, shit, maybe we should continue that. You know, maybe we should continue to take these fucking stabs in the dark, you know, and try and, like, showcase guys, and maybe they'll be good. You know, this is not a good philosophy to have as far as matchmaking goes. And I, truth be told, I really don't even know how much influence Steven Espinoza has as far as matchmaking. So, in any event,
I don't really know
what to expect from Oscar. Go ahead.
I just saw yet another mofo go behind my back, talking to you, telling me what, asking me this, telling that. Bruce Campbell, you are officially on notice that you too are going to get punched in the back of the head. It's going to happen.
Damn.
I'm calling out everybody right now.
And Corey Erdman just got in on it too.
What the hell, Erdman? I'm flying to Toronto, the back of your damn head. Hope you liked it.
Well,
hope you don't need it.
I'm going to go ahead and if I can add – well, first of all, Corey Erdman put out his first, you know, best Ron Stander fight, and he said Ron Stander versus sobriety at the Crawford-Gamboa fight. I'm going to go ahead and add to that and say Ron Stander versus Thorazine approximately 1981 on the streets of some city.
Oh.
That's just my guess.
Hey.
But, you know.
No, everybody loves Ron Stander. It's all affectionate. I thought he beat the hell out of the air the other night. I mean, he gave that air a beating of the kind it hasn't seen since, like, Brandon Rios last missed Manny Pacquiao, say.
Brutal.
Brutal.
Yeah, that was a little awkward. That was kind of like a handful of years ago when they had Joe Frazier, like maybe about 18 months before he passed on Friday Night Fights, and they're like, yeah, come over and hit the bag, champ. And I'm sitting there going, like, no, dude. And, I mean, it was Joe Frazier, so obviously nobody's going to be like, oh, dude, you look, like, horrible. But he was sitting there hitting the bag, and they were like, oh, he's still got his hook. And I'm like, fuck, man, this is terrible. It was just awkward. I mean, it was nice to, like, recognize Ron Stander in the crowd and everything, but it was just kind of awkward because he didn't really look that sober or with it.
No, but they probably still would have hurt. I mean, I think it probably would have done some damage to me anyway, but I'm fragile.
Oh, yeah, I didn't say I was going to get in the way of those motherfuckers. No way. I'm just a blogger, man. Just a blogger. So, with Oscar De La Hoya and this kind of dynamic shifting with, you know, Golden Boy and whoever's left at Golden Boy now being willing to work with Top Rank, and, you know, this kind of new fissure or fracture kind of opens up, you know, between Al Haymon and Richard Schaefer, whoever else is going to be involved on that side, we don't even know yet, really. You know, what does this mean long term for that immediate area around Floyd Mayweather, Miguel Cotto, you know, et cetera? What does that mean for those guys then?
Sorry, the situation with Golden Boy and everything? Is that what you said?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, with them, with the kind of the new fracture now opening up between Haymon and them, I'm just still kind of even struggling to understand what this means for the guys who are kind of semi-connected to Golden Boy and Haymon, I don't know. This is kind of a bizarre situation in the sport of boxing that it hasn't really encountered quite like this before, you know?
No, it's all totally pure speculation at this point. I mean, if you ask Oscar De La Hoya, he says he has a good relationship with Al Haymon. But, of course, he's also suing, you know, or semi these. There's a court case involving him and Richard Schaefer over what is probably Al Haymon, and Al Haymon, you know, hasn't been having his guys sign contracts with Golden Boy all that much, and you can make an argument that maybe he's been wanting to make it so that he could get out of Golden Boy if he wanted to get out of Golden Boy for whatever reason. I mean, it's just completely impossible to figure out who's going to be able to fight whom going forward, and I'm giving up on the air right now to even try to answer that question because there's no way of knowing. I don't think anybody knows. I don't think you know. I don't think any of the guys who are involved know. I don't think anybody knows right now how it's all going to play out or how it even could play out. And it seems like it's, you know, it's been affecting fights here and there, you know, based on what I've read, basically.
Yeah, and our buddy Joel Stern just tweeted that great fights for the fans, which is, of course, what Oscar has been repeating, equals bankruptcy, which probably is the truth, actually, unfortunately. But, you know, who knows how serious he really is with those claims anyway. So we have probably about 15 minutes left, but I did want to leave a couple minutes, and I know we've already kind of talked about it a little bit, and that's cool, but I did want to ask I think it's important. I think it's important to kind of get some word out about the Transnational Boxing Rankings Board. And I've said it before on Twitter, and it's not that I do disagree with anything that it does. It's just that it's still in its fledgling stage, and I still kind of am in a kind of cautious optimism type of, you know, I have that type of perspective towards it in that I do want to support it, and I do want to help get the word out and everything, but I'll kind of fall short of totally embracing it or really pimping it out to anybody. Just because, like I said, it is still kind of new, and it does still kind of remain to be seen what's going to happen with a lot of these things in boxing. Regardless, I do want to ask if you have any plans or anything specific or maybe not specific going on with the Transnational Boxing Rankings Board going forward in the next, I don't know, maybe year or so.
No, I think one of the things that we've been trying to, you know, it's there's no like here's our goal for this year. It's just a slow, steady, informational campaign, if you will, and you know, just hoping that more people hear about us and can make up their mind about us. That there's not a whole lot more to say than we have said already about it, I think.
Sure.
I encourage people to go to the site and judge for themselves, tbrb.org. I encourage people to listen to what Teddy's had to say. I encourage people to listen to what the critics have had to say, and, you know, read the things that we've written about those criticisms. Look at the discussion forums on the East Side Boxing website. Look at the comment section there. Look at the Twitter feed where we sometimes get people who want to challenge what we do, TBR Board on Twitter. And honestly, just keep telling people what it is. Hope that we went over more people bit by bit.
At very least, you know, at the very least, even if people aren't, even if they aren't on board, which is okay, you know, not everybody has to be all about it or, you know, like really pumping their fists about it or anything, and that's okay. But at the very least, I do think that having another option, just having something there available that is, you know, like if you look at the Box Rec rankings, for example, those are pretty much all numbers. They're pretty much all some little formula about if this number beats this number, then that adds up to being this number. And then if you look at, I think it's the IBO rankings, those are all computerized. And then you look at the friggin' sanctioning bodies, and they're basically arbitrary. Totally arbitrary. Nobody knows how they do. So having that other option there and having a little bit more of a clear description of what goes on, and on top of that also being able to clearly interact with the people who are responsible, being privy to discussions that are not necessarily private, but just, you know, kind of going back and forth about why this guy from France should be ranked 11th over this dude from, I don't know, Belarus at 112 pounds or something like that. You know, These are probably not compelling discussions for people to read all the time. But regardless, you're able to interact with the people who are making the decisions. And I think that's also important. It's a sense of accountability that they're really – it doesn't exist among the sanctioning bodies, and that's a big problem.
Yeah. I mean, every now and then we'll get dinged by people who will say, you know, we need to be even more open. And that's fine. People can say that. But look at who we're going up against right now. There are people who either have laughable results and aren't nearly as transparent as we are, or there are people who are more transparent, but maybe the system doesn't ring true. You know, BoxRec does a lot of good things, and I think there's some value to their rankings and the notion of computerized rankings, but you end up with some wacky stuff, and so it's hard for me to embrace that. I think we strike the right balance on all that stuff.
I kind of agree.
And if I'm not mistaken, and I mean, I haven't been paying super close attention, but did you at least somewhat, like, semi-recently add more people to the board?
Oh, it's a continual process. You know, we want to make sure we have a good geographical balance. We want to have people who pay really close attention to boxing in all the parts of the world, and you know, the founders are all American, but we have a British. He's one of the founders actually. So we have one non-British founder. I mean, sorry, not one non-American founder. And we have we have three chairs and one oversight. One of the chairs is Italian. But at the same time, it can be hard to find people who are both willing and that we're aware of in countries where we're not at. So we're always on the lookout for people who are in countries where we don't have people, or in the event that somebody fades away because they're not participating very often or decides to leave for whatever reason, we then have to try to find replacements for those areas of the world that we don't have representation. And that's a big part of what we're trying to do, is to have that international angle. It's helpful for, you know, a variety of just obvious reasons, but among them also, there's some parts of the world where smaller fighters are much more prominent, and the lower weight classes are more visible than they are in America. So that's good to have that perspective too. It's good to have the perspective of, okay, we can look at someone's resume, we can watch their fights, but we might not have a full picture of the Japanese scene, say, where we know that if you're the Japanese fighter A and you beat Japanese fighter B, that means a lot in Japan. How much do you weigh that on the world scene? And that's why it's helpful to have the perspective from the other countries. And then sometimes, you know, we don't mandate that everybody participate every single week, but, you know, we want to have a sufficient number where if 20 people or 25 people weigh in, we get a real good sense of what an educated opinion on who should be ranked where. You know, on any given week, we'll have a good group of people who are telling us, you know, when we put together the draft proposal, you're wrong, that's completely a bad choice, you should be looking at this person. And having people who are willing to say to us, we disagree with this, it's been easy to find, because boxing fans are pretty contrary types. But it's something that we need to, you know, we need to find people who fit the international profile, who fit the profile of being, you know, on top of it, and who fit the profile of wanting to be active. And at times that mix isn't going to be perfect, so we're going to have to keep refining our membership at all times, really.
Well, you know, Queensbury Rules in particular has had a lot of problems with its writers being really racist. So I wanted to know if you had any board members that were either African or Afro-Cubano, maybe?
We did have an African member. He has departed. We are on the lookout for a replacement member from the continent of Africa, although that's, you know, there's so many countries in Africa, I wouldn't want to just say the region of Africa is not well represented right now, and that's something I would like to see fixed. We have a variety of fighters from various island nations, but we do not have a Cuban writer as of right now, no. So we're on the
sounds
hunt
like a bunch of racists.
Signs. Sounds like a bunch of racists, although we do have some members of the Hispanic, of the Asian, of the African-American persuasion that are represented. We could do better, and we want to do better.
All right. Well, I figured that that would be like pretty much the wrap up of our show is that TBRB discussion.
Yeah,
I did want to get that out and just kind of, you know, have people visit that website. It's tbrb.org. If you guys want to check it out, there seem to be kind of a fairly unique, you know, lay of listeners every week because I get people every so often who, you know, seem to not even speak English that well, who will kind of contact us about the show every so often. So this is good. This is good to get this, to get the word out. But in any event,
we want to leave everybody in a way that we're both racist, and especially TQBR and TBRB are very, very racist. That's really the expression. I love you, Patrick.
Oh, man. Well, Tim, thanks a bunch for coming on and helping me entertain the masses, and we'll probably be back next week with Foley to do a more thorough preview of Canelo versus Lara, I suppose. We'll see what type of guest we can wrangle up. But Tim, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys. Well, check out, of course, tbrb.org and queensberryrules.com, and we will see you guys next week. Thanks a lot, and take it easy. Bye.